Hi, and welcome back to the second episode of the Long-Term Memory Radio documentary series, Anarchism, Freedom on the Air. Last week we asked the question, what is anarchism? We looked at common misperceptions and stereotypes, and discussed the concepts and theories that define anarchism. Today we will explore how these ideas have influenced and been influenced by history. We will focus on five events that have left a legacy for anarchism in theory and practice. The First International, the Haymarket Massacre, the Spanish Revolution, the 1968 popular uprisings in Paris, and the 1999 anti-WTO protests in Seattle. Stay tuned as we delve into the role that anarchism has played through the centuries.
The First International was an international workers' association that existed between 1864 and 1876. These years marked the beginning of a sharp ideological distinction between socialism and anarchism. There were intense rivalries between Marx, who spoke for the socialist camp, and Bakunin, who spoke in favor of anarchism. Eventually, Bakunin and the anarchists, who were very critical of the hierarchical structure of the organization, were arrested from the First International. To give us an overview of the First International, we spoke with Benoît Desgreniers. Benoît lives in Montreal and is a member of the Northeast Federation of Anarcho-Communists.
The period in question is the years of the International Working Men's Association from 1864 to 1876, otherwise known as the First International. These were pivotal years in the evolution of anarchism. It was a turbulent era which gave rise to the Paris Commune and was marked by deep political rivalries, notably between Karl Marx and Mikhail Bakunin. To begin with, some historical context. Could you give us an overview of where socialism stood in the middle decades of the 19th century?
This is obviously the century where we have a really burst of like socialism and different tendency in socialism, in which different thinker and different movements are basically putting their ideas out and challenging each other, debating each other. And I think in the context of the First International, in the context of especially working people movement, I mean, there's like three movements we can look more clearly. I mean, the first one, which is well known, which is, I'll start with the non-anarchist one, is definitely Marx. And then the two other thinkers in movement we should talk about is obviously, well, the first one is Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, and the second one is Michael Bakunin.
What was the purpose of forming the International Working Men's Association? What were its initial objectives?
First it was created in a situation in which there was a couple popular uprising that happened in Europe, especially in Poland. The Polish insurrection just happened. And a lot of people felt in Europe that they couldn't create a solidarity, although it was like the proletariat or the peasantry, but like poor people, working people, who would create uprising. They couldn't like basically, because a lot of them were hoping for that revolution that would like, you know, change the world, and especially change in capitalism was growing really fast and creating a lot of clash. So a lot of people, basically the point was to create a unity of all the proletariat across the globe, but at this point it was mostly Europe, but at least starting with Europe and starting with creating that unity and with different tendency too, because at first the principle of the international were at first actually quite libertarian. So obviously at this point, like, people didn't yet, like, there was debate, but people felt they could have a unity between the more like party-based, like the trade unionists, the anarchists, and obviously the collectivists. At this point, at the early part, the collectivists didn't exist yet as an organized movement, but different the mutualists, the anarchists, and the different other tendency, because there was like Italian communism, there was the early French socialists who had like all different visions. So they say, well, let's all get together and try to create that movement in which the more we are, the more unity we create, the more solidarity we create, then we can defeat capitalism.
1872 was the year when Bakunin was ousted from the First International. Could you elaborate on the conflict between Marx and Bakunin?
Basically, they were in the way because they were loud. I mean, Bakunin was an incredible speaker and an activist. Like, Marx was an incredible writer. By the time Marx spent at the library in London writing, Bakunin spent in prison and in an uprising, yelling and basically fighting on the street. And it was impressive and an ad follower. And obviously, these federations were like quite motivated to spread a more libertarian ideas around that. So Marx basically organized to, basically there was the General Congress, which was all the members, but there was also an elected General Council to do the day-to-day business of the International. And the council was elected from different people from different trades in different countries. That was basically truly respect the internationalist perspective, but obviously at that time we're talking about Europe and the United States pretty much. So basically what happened is Marx made sure that in the end, Marx and the Marxists made sure they controlled the General Council and called it like some meetings that were not that public and basically wanted to destroy the autonomy of the local section of the International, basically everything to be centralized, give more power to General Council to make decision. So, you know, like giving away the decision making power of the General Assembly, and also wanted to get rid of that federation idea, because the federation idea became really strong, especially in the South. So in 1872 in Hague, when was the meeting where the clash happened, obviously the Marxists basically expelled the anarchists, but outside of the political disagreement, there was also tons of interpersonal thing. An example was Bakunin was paid by Marx's editor to translate Das Kapital in Russian. Bakunin, who basically started translation but realized it was pretty long. I mean, anyone read Das Kapital, it's not an easy book to translate, first of all, but secondly, it was not really in the interest to translate it and had other stuff to do, basically participate in an uprising and you know, go organize and decided to take the money but not translate the book. And obviously, Marx's editor was quite upset about that. So all these things, I mean, I'm just giving an example, but all these things get mixed up in the political debate. Bakunin get expelled, all the other anarchist tendency, libertarian tendency left the International. And that's pretty much what the conflict can, if we can explain it briefly, because like I said, there's so much complexity in the debate and who was on which side, what exactly happened. But in the end, by 1872, right after the Commune of Paris, the anarchists got expelled, they left, and later formed also in their own federation to try to compensate for that.
The First International faded out of sight a few years later, somewhere around 1876. In your opinion, what was the reason for its demise?
A different reason. I mean, obviously the split didn't help. Like most of the activity of the International at this point was mostly Germany, England, and now the United States was becoming more active, but lost a lot of support in all the southern like Europe, and because of the split, and even some syndicalists were a lot of time neutral between that all like Marxist versus anarchist debate, like didn't have a good, you know, impression, and obviously started working a lot on their day-to-day things. And you know, like, yeah, we can work a lot, put a lot of energy in that International Federation, or we can put a lot of energy on our own union and then developing ideas, you know, like to struggle. So I think it's a mix of that, but also in 1872 the headquarters moved to New York City, and when most of the members were in Europe, it was really harder to, especially the General Council was like poorly attended, like people didn't show up. So I think in the end, like it's just like slowly wither away in a really like unclear way, because like that was a surprise, and this is something a lot of Marxists don't talk much about, because like, okay, the anarchists left, and you know, a lot of time in the criticism of a lot of time the Marxists, oh, the anarchists not really organized, they don't get their thing together, the revolution, anarchist revolution never happened, which, I mean, we can debate obviously, which is not totally true, but I mean at the same time we can look and say, well, what happened to the First International? You kicked out the anarchists and everything disappeared. The First International didn't survive without the anarchists, and that's a really clear important point to make.
Could you talk a bit about the formation of the Anarchist International at Saint-Imier in 1872, and how that organization subsequently evolved?
It basically functioned a little bit, but it was not as as strong as it could have been. I think a lot of it was because at the same time, anarchism, especially organized anarchist movement, not just the ideas, but like, and it was always organized, but it was more and more organized, stronger in Italy and Spain, you know, in Switzerland, in Belgium, and other countries too. Like, people didn't put enough energy to build their own movement in their local areas. So it didn't work that well in terms of, it didn't stay solid, but it always stayed there in different form and different variation. And basically, also what happened is the defeat, it was also a defeat for the anarchists of the organized side of things. The Paris Commune was a failure, got kicked out of the First International. A lot of anarchists also became fans of the propaganda by deed, and basically say, well, if we're not going to organize, we're going to basically, in quote unquote, blow up the social relationship. So put bombs, do direct action of that sort, assassination plot. So it was a hard time for the anarchist movement because you had on one side those who wanted to organize, whereas more in like mass movement, wanted to basically, you know, support workers everywhere, organize their own federation. On the other side, you had people who were more secret organization, secret action, create a clash. So obviously things were really hard to organize together. But later, way later in the century, the ideas always stayed. In 1968, basically, it got a rebirth, which was the Anarchist International, IE or like IAF. And basically right now there's a couple members. It's still fairly small. I think a lot of, it's still the same reality right now if we look at the anarchist movement right now. A lot of people say, well, the focus should be for people to develop local federation. We're not at the point of a real international, will be when we'll have like enough solid federation with like thousands of members in each area of the world. Then, you know, and obviously, but stay in contact. So basically, there's members like Fédération Anarchiste, example, and the Anarchist Federation in England are a member of the International, the Anarchist International. And I think that was an example of the failure a bit of the First International, was to look at, well, you know, how can you create an international when you only have like, you know, small part of Europe and North America.
Judge Thayer told his friends around that he had cut the radicals down. Anarchist Bastard was the name Judge Thayer called these two good men. I'll tell you the prosecutor's name, Katzman, Adams, Williams, Kane. The judge and lawyer strutted down, they done more tricks than circus clowns. Two good men.
Oh, baby, don't you, the Haymarket Affair, a pivotal event in the history of both the anarchist and labor movements, really took off on May the 4th, 1886, in Chicago.
To the bright light city, sweet old Chicago.
Striking workers were holding a peaceful meeting in Haymarket Square when the police began to approach and ordered the meeting to be dispersed. A bomb was thrown into the crowd of police, instantly killing at least one and injuring many others. In the aftermath, eight of Chicago's most well-known anarchist leaders were put on trial and charged for murder. This event would change the face of anarchism all over the world.
To that bright light city, sweet old Chicago. Well, all right, man.
Here, Howard Zinn will take us back to the Haymarket Square in Chicago in 1886 to give us an in-depth look into the situation. Howard Zinn is a professor at the University of Boston. He is a historian, activist, playwright, author, and lover of freedom. Of his many books, his most famous is A People's History of the United States. Of course, we're doing a documentary looking at the history of anarchism, and one of the things we wanted to focus on was the struggle for the 8-hour workday and the Haymarket incident. Mm. So maybe you could start by taking us back to that and explaining how exactly the struggle for the 8-hour workday came about and how it was influenced by anarchists.
Well, the struggle for the 8-hour day, you know, began before the 1880s. That was before that dramatic event of the Haymarket affair. There had been campaigns for lowering the hours of the workday from the beginning of the 19th century. But by the 1880s, and by this time, there have been a number of national labor organizations, the Knights of Labor, and in the 1880s, the American Federation of Labor was formed. And so by the 1880s, there was a kind of national movement for an 8-hour day, and took the form of strikes in various parts of the country, and there were some successes with these strikes to the 8-hour day, but probably the important turning point in the movement for the 8-hour day came in 1886 with the Haymarket affair. And what happened there was in Chicago, that there was a strike in that city against the International Harvester Company, which was a big company manufacturing farm products, farm machinery. And a clash on the picket line, the police shot a number of the strikers. This led to an immediate cry of protest, which was led by the anarchists. That is, there was a strong anarchist movement in Chicago. Some of these anarchists had come over from Germany, where there was a very powerful radical movement, to some extent influenced by Karl Marx, or to some extent influenced by Bakunin, the anarchist. But there were also Native American, that is, people who were born in the United States who became leading anarchists. So one of these was Albert Parsons, who in fact was an American white person who had come from the South, who had in fact fought for the Confederacy during the Civil War, and sometime after that became socially conscious and became a radical and became a part of the anarchist movement in Chicago. So the anarchist movement in Chicago was quite strong, quite influential. They had their own newspaper called The Alarm. And they reacted to the shooting of the strikers at the International Harvester plant by calling for a protest rally to take place at Haymarket Square in Chicago. And that happened a couple of days later. That rally was a peaceful rally attended by, we don't know how many, 1,000 or 2,000 people. It was addressed by various people, including some of the anarchist leaders. And it was a peaceful meeting, as everybody reported. But at a certain point, when the meeting was almost over, contingent of police arrived and demanded that the meeting come to an end, and the person on the platform said, "No, we are almost finished, and we insist on our right to continue speaking," whereupon the police barged into the crowd with their clubs, and at that point a bomb exploded in the midst of the police, and 7 policemen were killed, a number were injured, whereupon the police themselves began shooting and clubbing and killing a number of people in the crowd. That was the Haymarket affair. In fact, nobody ever knew who threw the bomb that exploded amidst the police. To this day, there are all sorts of speculation, but never any clear evidence about who threw the bomb. And certainly there was no clear evidence at that time. But the Chicago police insisted that whoever threw the bomb must have been provoked by the anarchists. And it's true, the anarchists very often wrote provocative leaflets and provocative articles, and they were not totally nonviolent people. However, there was certainly no evidence that they were responsible for that bomb. What happened in Chicago then was that the eight leading anarchists in Chicago were arrested and put on trial for conspiracy. Now, the interesting thing about about conspiracy law, which is still used all over the country and used in federal law, in conspiracy law, you don't have to prove that anybody actually did anything. You just have to prove that they planned to do something. They were tried under the conspiracy law on the claim that whoever did throw the bomb was inspired by the anarchists, and they were convicted by a jury, and then they were sentenced to death, eight of them. I'm thinking of 9/11. I'm thinking of September 11th, 2001, when this terrorist attack occurred in New York and in Washington, and 3,000 people were killed. Well, the government of the United States immediately declared war on terrorism and immediately attacked and invaded Afghanistan. And then, of course, as we see a year later, invades and attacks Iraq. I would guess that this is something that the United States had wanted to do anyway. Wanted to get more footholds in the Middle East, wanted to get more military bases, wanted to get rid of government in Iraq. Dictator or not, the United States had never cared particularly whether government was dictatorial or not, just cared whether that government would play cooperatively with the United States, wanted to get rid of a government that controlled a huge amount of oil that is in Iraq and was not cooperative with the United States. So the cataclysmic event of September 11th created an opportunity for the United States government to do what it had wanted anyway. And I think the Haymarket affair gave the Chicago police an opportunity to lop off get rid of the top leadership of the anarchist movement in Chicago. You know, the Haymarket affair was a stimulus to certain anarchists. I mean, there's a very specific example of Emma Goldman, the American anarchist feminist, who as a young girl in 1887 heard of the execution of the four anarchist leaders. And this aroused her to a fury, got her interested in anarchist ideas. She went to New York and became involved with an anarchist group in New York, including Alexander Berkman.
We want to kind of draw out some of the legacies of the Haymarket affair. What do we see now, within workers' movements, within the anarchist movement that came out from this time?
I mean, all we can say is that the labor movement continued to grow in the United States. And there were always radical influences in the labor movement. The labor movement has always consisted of people who are in the labor movement simply to get better conditions for workers. But the labor movements have always had, as some of their most important, most active members, people who went beyond that, people who wanted more than better working conditions and shorter hours and better pay, people who wanted a change, radical change in the economic system. You had strikes in the United States, a huge number of strikes in the late 19th, early 20th century. So anarchists always played a kind of leading role in whatever movements, especially labor movements, there have been.
To the bright light city, sweet old Chicago.
The Spanish Civil War of 1936 was a defining event in the history of anarchism. In response to an attempted fascist coup, a workers' coalition organized to collectivize factories and farmlands and form popular militias to resist the fascist forces. Martha Acklesberg is a professor in the Department of Government at Smith College in Massachusetts, where she offers courses in political science and women's studies. She has done extensive research on the anarchist movement in Spain, with a particular focus on the role of women within the anarchist movement. Her book, Free Women of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women, is a well-known analysis of the Spanish anarchist women's organizations and how they situated themselves in relation to the largely male-dominated Spanish anarchist movement. Her book will be reprinted this year by AK Press. Today she will speak to us about the Spanish Civil War and its importance as a fundamental event in the history of anarchism, as well as the role of women's groups within the movement.
A Republican government came into Spain starting in around 1931, after many years of monarchy. During ensuing years, there was a lot of pressure from both the right and the left. The left wanting land reform, protection of workers, access to education, you know, a whole range of opening up of the society on the basis of more democratic values and principles. And the right, of course, wanted that not to happen and to go back to a more traditional. There had been an anarchist movement in Spain since the last third, really, of the 19th century, which before the advent of the Republic had to go underground. It was a time of dictatorship, and all left-wing organizations, certainly the anarchists and the socialists, were severely repressed. But there had been an anarchist movement as well as a socialist movement. And in 1931, with the coming of the Republic, many of those more repressive laws and practices were lifted. So you had a certain opening in the early part of the 30s. In the spring, February of 1936, there was another series of elections and a, let's say, progressive coalition known as the Popular Front, which included Republicans, socialists. The anarchists did not participate in the coalition, but they did not advocate opposing the election. This progressive coalition won and began land reform and, again, giving workers somewhat more power, allowing for union organizing, etc. And the right was getting increasingly anxious about that. In July of 1936, four generals attempted a coup d'etat. That failed, and what resulted was the Spanish Civil War. They were opposed in some of the major cities, Barcelona, Valencia, Madrid, by organized workers. What resulted was 3 years of civil war with the military, which was led ultimately by Francisco Franco, trying to reassert the more traditional Spain, and all of the groups on the left trying to defeat them. Now, the left, of course, was not united. Once the Civil War began, anarchists and socialists began collectivization of land and worker takeover of factories and workplaces because many of the owners of these places fled. They were sympathizers of Franco and the rebels. So you had spontaneous or not quite so spontaneous worker takeover and collectivization. You had people who were saying, we shouldn't be doing this now. Our main struggle is to, you know, fight the war against fascists, etc. The other thing I think that's important to know and understand about the Spanish Civil War is that shortly after it began, within a month or two, there was a major international meeting at which the U.S., Britain, France, the Soviet Union, Germany, and Italy, among others, participated. And they all pledged not to intervene in the Spanish Civil War. Germany and Italy basically announced at the time that they were not going to abide by that agreement and proceeded almost immediately to send war materiel and soldiers to the right. the U.S., Britain, and France did, for the most part, maintain their non-intervention stance, which meant that the Republican government could get virtually no support from the outside. The only two outside supporters were Mexico and the Soviet Union. And the fact that the Soviet Union was the main supporter of the Republic had a number of consequences. It significantly strengthened the role of the Communist Party in Spain. You know, with the money coming in from the Soviet Union, they were able to dictate how the war was to be fought, who was going to have power, etc. And ultimately, that power was used to crush the anarchists and the more radical socialists.
I'd like to go back to what you were saying about the industry and the land that collectivized, as well as the militias. That was actually done to quite a large extent. How is this possible?
Well, it was possible because there had been an anarchist movement, a very active anarchist movement in Spain for 50, 60 years. So you had activists who had been thinking and planning and talking for years about revolutionary social change. There had been worker committees, unions at various factories, and when managers and owners and leaders of these factories disappeared, the union organizations took over. They had groups of people in place to be able to undertake this kind of activity.
To what extent did women's groups participate in anarchist movements before the revolution? Were there women involved in the resistance right from the start?
There were women involved from a pretty early stage, but most of the women that I spoke to pointed out that, with relatively few exceptions, they weren't taken tremendously seriously by their male colleagues. But an organization, Mujeres Libres, which means free women, really started forming in the months before the Civil War began. There were women within the anarchist communities who were starting to organize themselves, and when the Civil War broke out, they were absolutely there. Women were involved in some of the very early efforts to supply the militias. I mean, there were women who actually went off to be part of the militia. They ran communal dining services, moved into factories, and Mujeres Libres really did a lot in the area of consciousness raising, trying to set up daycare centers, trying to help women find their voices in the collectives, provided them training so they wouldn't feel so inadequate in trying to deal with these new situations. So they were actually quite involved.
Can you talk a bit more about the ideological conflict within the sort of anti-fascist movement that eventually led to the suppression of the anarchist movement?
One dimension of the conflict had to do, as I was saying, with the role of the Soviet Union and the kind of larger international context. Britain, France, the United States, and the Soviet Union were all worried about fascism. But at that point, Britain, France, and the United States were also worried about communism. Stalin's Popular Front policy in the Soviet Union was to downplay the kind of more revolutionary aspects of the Soviet Union and of what was going on in Spain. And what that meant within the Spanish context was to oppose the collectivizations and to what was called militarize the militias. Ultimately, since the communists and people who supported them were the ones who had the money, guns, and had the ammunition, they were able to force that through. And that, for many anarchists, I think, felt like the beginning of the end. The anarchists really believed they were fighting a war, but they were also fighting a revolution, that there was a social revolution going on. And that was precisely what the communists, interestingly enough, opposed. In the spring of 1937, largely communist-dominated troops reversed the collectivizations. So you had really a civil war within the civil war that was going on.
What are some of the lasting legacies from the Spanish Civil War for anarchism and for feminism in general?
The fact that this women's organization, Mujeres Libres, was able to function effectively, even in the middle of a civil war, to empower women. That was, I believe, tremendously important. This was really, if not the only, then certainly one of the only women-led radical revolutionary movements of that period, and, you know, maybe one could say of almost any time, that was really able to operate within that larger context, but say we need attention to the specific concerns of women. They were really, in a sense, calling the anarchists to account and demanding that the anarchist movement live up to its commitment to equality for men and women. I mean, that had been there and sort of in the rhetoric of the anarchists going back to the 1870s. But these women were saying, we need this and we need it now. And just as the anarchist movement as a whole was saying, we can't wait until after the Civil War is ended before we try to make this social revolution and create this new society that we want to live in, that making the revolution is part and parcel of fighting against the fascists. In almost exactly an analogous way, the women were saying that we need women fully in this struggle as autonomous, fully capable, equal beings, and the only way to do that is to engage women through and with an organization that takes them seriously as actors in their own right. And I think that's a very powerful message that nobody's really done that before. It's a revolutionary, to use, for want of a better word, approach and set of achievements.
And very important for the anarchist movement in general as well.
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
En la plaza de mi pueblo dijo el jornalero al amo.
En la plaza de mi pueblo dijo el jornalero al amo. Nuestros hijos nacerán con el puño levantado. Nuestros hijos nacerán con el puño levantado.
Tierra que no es mía, esta tierra que es del amo.
Esta tierra que no es mía, esta tierra que es del amo. La riego con mi sudor.
La revolución. La revolución, ça dérange. La revolución, ça s'arrange.
What happened in Paris 1968? To look at anarchist involvement in the popular uprisings of 68, we spoke with Pierre Leroux. Pierre teaches at a college in Laval, Quebec, and was present in Paris during that revolutionary period.
Perhaps to begin, I'll begin with a brief reminder of the international situation of the time, because 1968 was part of an era of liberation in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America. It was also the period associated with the problem of revisionism. We mustn't forget that Prague Spring occurred in 1968. So the Communist parties had lost some of their credibility. In France, there were economic difficulties. In 1967, there had been a large miners' strike, and French society in general remained very authoritarian, very hierarchical. Most of the groups which were involved in 1968 predominantly consisted of young people, be it the Marxist-Leninists, which were created in reaction against the revisionist French Communist Party, or the Trotskyist groups, which evolved out of various student groups. There were also the anarchist groups, which could be subdivided into two categories: the traditional anarchist groups, which developed out of the Spanish Revolution and even earlier, and then the more recent anarchist groups related to the thinkers such as Marcuse, such as the Situationists. And then there were, of course, the Maoist groups. I should mention that I was involved primarily with one such group. The events of 1968 basically began with March 22nd, which was the Mouvement des Enragés de Nanterre, which was a movement consisting of various university regulations in France, which were completely anachronistic. That group was very significant in launching a resurrection and a new role for the French anarchist movement. movement, primarily among youth and the student movement. So there was the neo-anarchism, we might say very anti-authoritarian, anti-hierarchy, and beside that, you would have the Fédération Anarchiste and the CNT, which was anarcho-syndicalist and which was active mainly in the factories.
D'une part, les occupations d'usines ont montré que dans un pays
On one hand, the factory occupations showed that direct action in an advanced capitalist state was quite possible, and that self-management was also possible, both basic anarchist principles. The factory occupations were more than simply occupations, in the sense that the workers were consciously taking back part of what they considered to be theirs, since they were the ones who had generated the wealth for the capitalists, and also in the sense that it abolished the separation between workplace and residence, because the occupations were obviously continued 24 hours a day. Communal kitchens were created, tasks were delegated, a whole system of collective living was being constructed. All of this represented a political position which for the traditional movements, such as the Communist Party or the CNT, represented a danger, because it was beyond their control and direction. So it was in a way a return to the spirit of 1936, when people had shown, on a large scale, how workplaces could be reclaimed and managed by workers. In the education system, one major achievement was that the old systems of education run by its mandarins, meaning the elite, untouchable professors, disappeared, and the old divisions between faculty also disappeared as a new system with a more participatory involvement of students, teachers, and support personnel. What also changed was that whereas traditionally you had the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, the PSU, now when people want to organize, they have the chance to take things into their own hands and act outside of existing structures.
Veulent s'organiser, ont la possibilité donc de prendre en main ces affaires et puis de les gérer en dehors des structures en place.
From November 29th to December the 3rd, 1999, the World Trade Organization planned to hold a round of ministerial talks in Seattle, and it was going to be business as usual. What they never expected was the fight of their lives. WTO, along with its capitalist, neoliberal trade policies, were met in the streets of Seattle by tens of thousands of activists. While they faced severe police brutality and repression for days on end, they managed to effectively shut down the meetings.
And we're not going to be intimidated by rubber bullets.
Seattle was a turning point in the worldwide anti-capitalist movement. While it certainly wasn't the first of its kind, it set the tone for many street demonstrations to come in places like Genoa, Washington, Prague, Quebec City, and Cancun. Author Naomi Klein called it the coming out party of the movement.
The world, and we see through their disguise if they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flag unfurled.
The interesting thing about this demonstration and others to follow was that it was heavily influenced by anarchist tactics and principles. Not since Spain in 1936 had so many people been organizing in affinity groups, and suddenly, the Black Bloc and Spokes Council meetings were common parlance.
We will shut them down. Got the chorus yet? That's it.
Here we will hear from Roger, who lives in Seattle, and Nadine Block. Nadine is an anti-authoritarian organizer in Washington, D.C., and attended the Seattle demonstrations in 99 with the Ruckus Society. Roger attended the anti-WTO demonstrations in 1999 and is a member of the Seattle Anarchist Response and works at the Left Bank Bookstore.
We will shut them down. They'd have a world full of strip malls, plants grown by biotech, as long as they get richer.
The advent of this round of the World Trade Organization talks was people all over the world had been protesting the World Bank and the other international financial institutions, the IMF, and other repressive global trade systems for quite a while, ever since the Bretton Woods meetings which established the World Bank and the IMF, people have been out demonstrating. And certainly, you know, this marks the fifth anniversary, basically, of the existence of the World Trade Organization, which was founded on the failed negotiations of the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, and problems that they were running into with all different kinds of GATS treaties.
It really started more than a year ago in terms of organizing locally. I mean, the work that anarchists did went back at least 8 to 12 months in Seattle. So it was organizing up until those 5 days, and then it was all the activities that actually occurred in the street, anything that you saw when you happened to be there, anarchists were involved in it one way or the other, as well as smaller affinity groups, you know.
How did you feel that the Seattle demonstration was guided by anarchist principles? I mean, what kind of anarchist tactics were employed here that really shaped the face of that demonstration?
Well, certainly horizontal organizing, as opposed to most leftist organizing that had taken place up until the WTO for the last 50 years or so. Finally, we broke away from some of the larger lefty groups, started working in small, the affinity groups started to come into as a model, and building up through affinity groups until smaller temporary I think there's much more of an emphasis on temporary groupings.
We had a lot of support from different people who believed in using collective decision-making structures, a lot of consensus. Some of the best work was done in what we call affinity group and spokes council structures, which give important decisions to the small groups that are taking part in the decision-making. Most of those decisions were made by a consensus process. And within non-hierarchical structures that had a great emphasis on training and support for people learning new roles. And in fact, I mean, that's always been a really big part of the work is, you know, to make sure that the information gets and the skills get passed on. And a whole, also there was a whole huge piece of do-it-yourself and movement as well. So there were a lot of what some people may not actually identify as anarchists, but in fact are some core principles of anarchism that were in action in Seattle organizing.
I mean, the left has controlled every aspect of protest in this country, or you know, quote unquote, radical action, since the '60s, but even before that. I mean, really, it was like the crushing of the Spanish Revolution and all that way back when, the destruction of the IWW in this country, and the co-optation of the labor movement that really sank the left. But the remnants of the left have been stumbling on since that point, and to the point where before WTO, you couldn't get a protest of more than 20 people in this, at least in Seattle, and I know from growing up in Boston myself, anarchist ideas always being under the thumb of lame leftist organizations, essentially statist organizations.
Maybe you could just explain the idea behind an affinity group and how they played an important role in the Seattle demonstrations.
Well, it's partially security. I mean, it's common sense. If you're going to do actions, that you need to know the people you're involved with, you know, hopefully you try to have some kind of history, especially if it's radical actions, you need to have you need to build from the spokes council, that from the affinity group model, from the smaller groupings, but those groups need to work through a larger democratic process. But I think essentially the affinity group model is a useful one for any type of action.
One kind of interesting phenomenon in the popular mass media eye was the idea of a black bloc, which certainly gained a lot of notoriety after Seattle. Maybe you could help to demystify some of the things around the black bloc, so what it actually was and what kind of role it played in Seattle.
First off, I mean, obviously the black bloc is not a group, it's a tactic. A tactic is something, is not a strategy. A strategy is a larger, overarching way of approaching any given situation. Tactic is more for a particular instance. And in this particular instance, the idea was to sort of wake people up and shock them up. It was an instance of the black bloc. It was more to even like show off the tactic that. It was a possibility, because up until that point here in the U.S., that type of thing had not been done. Certainly in the 30s, you had strikers and you had people rioting. You've seen much worse type of property destruction in this country than the black bloc displayed. But the media sort of blocks that out. So I think the Eugene anarchists, at least, were correct in saying we wanted to break the spell, break the sort of media spell that nothing else is possible except to hold signs and sit down in the street nonviolently and get your ass kicked. So that's what it sort of did. I think it awakened the imagination of some youth that other things are possible. Sabotage, for instance, never on the radar screen. Something that small groups can do. So that's what it did, generally speaking.
It's just been a really unbelievable display of unruliness and a very difficult day for police.
And I think our officers are exercising remarkable restraint.
It was the actions of the protesters, the demonstrators, that led them to take the actions they did.
There is not one corner of this downtown area that has not fell victim to this destruction.
The protesters vowed to bring anarchy to downtown Seattle for another day.
I mean, to you, what was kind of the stereotype created around anarchists at this time? How did you see anarchists being portrayed in mainstream media?
Well, of course, there was no stereotype except for the typical untrue stereotype of the long bearded black cloaked bomb throwing anarchist until the WTO actually hit the media. Then suddenly everyone was an expert on what anarchists were, and it was pretty much the same type from within the left, from even within anarchist quarters themselves. The idea that there are many conservative anarchists who are out and about, and they claim the youthful anarchists in Seattle that broke windows were no better than fascists. Generally, it was the typical one of violent anarchists. Of course, there were no anarchists perceived as being, doing constructive things, but plenty of them. People fed people. People did, child care. People built things, housed people, everything that ordinary people do. And anarchists are ordinary.
This has been an examination of five pivotal events that helped to shape anarchist history. Next week, on the third edition of Anarchism, Freedom on the Air, we will examine how individuals and groups apply anarchist theories in their daily lives. This documentary has been a production of CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio.
How the Republic of the People can happen anytime. This is a permanent free zone. This is a permanent free zone. I am a permanent free zone.